Thank you guys for coming out to Sundays with the Modern. This is a tour program led by artists, art historians, architects, and people from related fields. We're actually not going to meet next week, but we'll resume again on February 13th. Today, we're fortunate to have Dr. Jennifer Way, Associate Professor of Art History at the University of North Texas in Denton. She specializes in the history, methodology, and theory of art since 1900. She earned her master's from Vanderbilt University and her PhD from the University of Texas at Austin. She's on the editorial board of Mobius, the Journal of Critical Approaches to Culture and Technology, and she also serves as editor of the Historians of British Art newsletter. Her essays have been published in journals including Material Culture Review, Journal of Material Culture, Post-Identity, the Journal for Cultural Research, and the Canadian Journal of History. And then to highlight just a few examples from a long list of awards... I have to get these out. They're impressive. She was recently awarded the Terra Foundation for American Art Senior Fellowship at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the President's Council Teaching Award at UNT, and in 2003, she received the Fulbright Senior Fellowship Award from the Council for the International Exchange of Scholars. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jennifer
Way.
Wow,
who's that? Okay, am I talking through this? Does this sound right? Yeah, so I am really excited about Smithsonian because I'll be in Washington all summer doing research. So that'll be really interesting. Okay, what I thought I would talk about today is very thematically driven, and we're going to stay downstairs. And what I wanted to focus on is post-industrialism. And the reason I wanted to do that is because people like me who study art and culture since 1900 tend to focus on making sense of art in two major contexts. One is industrialism and industrial society, and the other is post-industrialism. And we even somewhat divide these up into times. We think of industrialism as really impacting art but waning about the middle of the 20th century, and then we shift into a post-industrial society and culture. Now, the way that we connect those to art is modern and postmodern. Modernism we think about as the art that responds very directly to industrialism and industrial culture. Doesn't mean it's caused by it, but engages with it. Conversely, or correspondingly, postmodernism we understand as the cultural response or art that engages with post-industrial connections or contexts. So what I think we should do first is talk a little bit more about what we mean by post-industrial, what that term tells about, and then I hope we have time to look at four pieces downstairs in the permanent collection. I'm not saying that they look the same, they certainly don't, or that they relate to each other in a particular way, but we can talk about each of them as thematically linked in some way to post-industrialism, and I think it's very interesting in regard to how. Okay, and so in a way, I'd like to dedicate this talk to Daniel Bell. Do any of you know who Daniel Bell is or was? He just died this week in his 90s. He was an emeritus scholar at Harvard for many years. He was very typical of a generation of scholars associated with the left wing, with socialism. His parents were European-born. He came over as an immigrant in the early 20th century. He studied sociology, first teaching at Chicago. He got a PhD at Columbia, and he ended up spending his career in New York City and then Harvard. He wrote books all through the second half of the 20th century that tried to make connections between changes in the economy and society and culture. One of the first books he wrote is called Notes on Work from 1956, which he talks about the sociology of work and how workaday life is changing. The book that's really important for us in terms of post-industrialism is The Coming of Post-Industrial Society. When do you think he wrote it? 73. So he was writing it right on the cusp of when he was detecting, he and others were detecting, this major shift from the economy and society of industrial to post-industrial. Okay, so have you ever heard the term post-industrial? What does it say? What does it say to you?
To me, it relates to our economy service.
Absolutely. Anything else?
Information services and internet and things like that.
shifting from obtaining and using raw materials to manufacture goods and finding ever greater ways to be more productive in the output to an economy that's largely driven by information and service, as well as culture. In a nutshell, that's the kind of shift that he's talking about. A couple of other things that he mentioned as well. There's four key things. One we've talked about, a shift from manufacturing to services as the key part of what grows our economy and to what our society responds to. And this means really shifting from skilled and semi-skilled labor as the basis of our workforce to information processing and knowledge, okay, and services. Related to this is the importance or the centrality of science-based industries. This is the rise of the technocrat. Somebody who's trained in technology and who understands and forges connections between technology and information. Whereas we could have said our society used to have an infrastructure based on transportation or moving things, goods. Now it's based on communication. In other words, from stuff to process, from things to ideas, texts, information. This is key. The other thing that happens is the rise of new information and the advent of different kinds of class structures. The way that we get around in society and rise from one economic level to another is now pretty much based on education. It's not based on the inheritance of property. It's not based on the inheritance of a way of life, such as a job or an industry. Social mobility is based on education. And social capital, the importance of who you are and how you're important, is also based on your access to opportunities and social networks. So, does anybody see the network movie that's out now? I mean, we're really talking about the kind of shift that movie is portraying. The other key aspect of this is the central place that consumerism and consumption plays in both our economy and culture. Just as we say that information and services are key and that we're shifting from emphasizing the production of things to the production of process and services, what we're also seeing in the economy, especially since the middle of the 20th century, is the real importance on maintaining consumer drive, consumer interest, markets that will always be stimulated to want more and more, or to desire purchasing, to desire consuming things, including culture. But creating and maintaining the drive to consume drives the economy, as opposed to intensifying production. And within this framework, which gives rise to and intensifies industries like entertainment and leisure, culture becomes truly an industry. If you watch Entertainment Tonight on television that talks about film and movie stars and things like that, one of the main themes that they have is talking about money, how much a film grossed on its first day out, how much this cost or earned, etc. There's many ways when we think about branding, and the way that corporations and other kinds of philanthropic enterprises fund museums. There's many ways to think about the ways that new kinds of information-based and technology monies and industries are inputting into the cultural realm and helping to shape culture as an industry. Okay. Somebody else you might think of in terms of post-industrial is Manuel Castells. He's written a series of books that talk about the network society and some of these changes in relation to culture. Any questions or things that I'm not thinking about?
This all started about 1973.
Well, that's when Daniel Bell wrote this book called The Coming of Post-Industrial Society, A Venture in Social Forecasting.
Is that really?
I think people have seen those shifts since around the middle of the 20th century. Particularly with the drive, you can think of, what's the advertising show? What's the show on TV about?
Mad Men.
Mad Men is totally about that shift. The rise of Madison Avenue as a drive for the interests and themes of culture. Oftentimes people will look at the history of Western art and talk about pop art, the relationship of fine art and popular culture as an early response to the kind of changes that we're talking about. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? So what I thought we would do is look at four pieces. We'll start, I think, closest to us with Francis Bacon's self-portrait from 1956. Art historians focus on it because art history today is so context-driven in terms of society and economy and culture. And so this is just part of the framework of studying art since 1900. What I wanted to talk about a little bit in regard to Francis Bacon's self-portrait is not necessarily the way it looked or how it came about, but this is a good example of a shift in what art historians study in regard to an art. You know, what are people doing research on? There's been a shift in research in Francis Bacon that moves from industrial society concerns to post-industrial themes. And let me just say that when I say industrial society, one of the ways that Bacon has traditionally been studied is in terms of the materials that he consults to make his paintings. He was known as one of the earliest artists who, since the late 40s and then on to the 1950s and thereafter, made a virtue of deriving a lot of the subject matter of his art from already published imagery. He looked at newspapers, magazines, any kind of mass print media that he would gather and use in various ways. He used it as a resource for ideas. He used it as a style resource in some ways, picking and choosing bits and pieces here and there, particularly even reproductions of works of art. Think of the Pope paintings that he made that reference images of popes from the 16th and 17th centuries. He's getting those from reproductions of already existing paintings, so several times removed. And he's well known for talking to interviewers in ways that explain this source material, and I'll give you two examples. In 1966, he said to David Sylvester, a famous art historian interviewer in England, he said, "Another thing that made me think about the human cry," because he was depicting human cries in his paintings, people looking like they were screaming or yelling, "was a book that I bought when I was very young from a bookshop in Paris, a secondhand book with beautiful hand-colored plates of the diseases of the mouth. Beautiful plates of the mouth open and of the examination of the inside of the mouth, and they fascinated me, and I was obsessed by them. And then I saw, perhaps I even knew by then, the Potemkin film, and I attempted to use that still, the photograph of the film, as a basis on which I could also use these marvelous illustrations of the human mouth." And later on, he said also, "Images can help me find and realize ideas. I look at hundreds of very different contrasting images, and I pinch details from them, rather like people who eat from other people's plates." Okay. And because of an interest in how people work, scholars, until recently, have focused on his process, what he did with all this stuff, and trying to trace the effects of his having this in his studio to, for example, perhaps the blurred aspect of some of his faces or the shift of movement that we see, or trying to identify particular images and root them in certain kinds of original source material. There's been a huge shift, though, in what people are researching on Bacon, and I'll just mention two things. One is that they've turned an interest in his process into data. I don't know if any of you have seen his studio in Dublin, but in the late 1990s, he was a gay man, one of his last lovers gave his studio, his long years of working in this studio in South Kensington in London, gave the rights to everything in this studio that he used for decades to the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin. And the gallery hired archaeologists and anthropologists to meticulously, piece by piece by piece, of every single thing in this studio, every scrap of detritus that they could pull up, to tag and catalog like it was an archaeological site and create an electronic database where everything has is turned into information. And so it's a kind of transposition of the life of the artist in this studio and his process into an information database where everything is a discrete piece of information. And now scholars are trying to make sense of, well, now what do we do with all this data? You know, what does this really tell us about? And so if you ever get a chance and you're in Dublin, go into the Hugh Lane Gallery, and it's in the back, and you'll be floored at the minutiae of things. You can also go online to their gallery. They have quite a lot of information and reproductions. There's over 7,500 items. The database has 570 books and catalogs, 1,500 photographs, 100 slashed canvases, 1,300 leaves torn from books, 2,000 artist materials, 70 drawings. There's correspondence, magazines, newspapers, and vinyl records. So this information, this emphasis on data and knowledge really connects to the post-industrial. Another thing that does in regard to the shift in how Bacon is studied is an emphasis on reception. And we see this quite a lot in art history, a shift overall, just besides Bacon, of moving from an emphasis on the artist as the source for meaning, or the artist as the origin of what a work is and what it's all about, shifting to consumption. Just like the economy and society, art historians are interested in what things mean to people. In particular, they're looking at things like the glass that we see in front of the painting. Now, you might look at this and think, why doesn't the modern get rid of that annoying glass you cannot even see in the painting? It's always reflecting us. That's not the museum's fault. That's a condition of many of Bacon's paintings. And scholars are beginning to ask, well, why did he interfere with our vision in this way, in such a sense that it's reflected back to us and provides some kind of visual noise that gets in the way of our even seeing what he's doing? And they're now taking that seriously as part of the perceptual activity that we have on this side of the work, and paying attention to understanding with what's going on and making sense of his paintings based on how we are interacting with them. Another part of that is that they're paying attention to something called synesthesia. You ever heard that word, synesthesia? Syn together and aesthesia, aesthetic, feeling. What it suggests is that one kind of feeling or sense can trigger another one. The best example that people always use is color. You see the color blue, but you hear a particular sound. Or you hear a sound and you see a particular color. And in some people for whom this is extreme, it's really difficult to function in life because their senses are triggering one another in ways that make it difficult to get through everyday life. One of the things that scholars are doing is paying attention especially to Bacon's paintings. This one not so much is a good example, but it gives us a little bit. He does a lot with the materiality of paint so that it clumps up off the surface. And in some paintings, it really is an impasto kind of bulk of stuff. Some of it's goopy, streaming, splattered, and they're paying attention to what that tactility does or evokes in our reception. They're talking about ways of seeing that are very haptic, that look over surfaces, that pay attention to the weave and the touch and the feeling of things, so that sight or vision triggers some kind of feeling sensation when we're looking at his work. So that's another connection that they're paying attention to in regard to his painting. But these are all about use and consumption. What's happening when we're paying, when we're perceiving the work, not making it, not putting it together, not about its exhibition history, but reception. Okay. Questions or comments? Yeah, but that was there from the beginning. This is just a turn. The only reason I'm talking about this because it suggests a real shift in the themes that scholars are studying in regard to an artist. And they have the potential to sort of re-narrate or retell us why this artist is important in the first place. He did. He slashed a lot of his early canvases. He tried to destroy them. Exactly, right. But yet he kept a lot of them around. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to the Gerhard Richter painting. So this is a painting that I want to explore in relation to post-industrialism in a different way from the Bacon, okay? I'm not saying they even relate to one another. This is a different theme. And so the reason that I'm having us look and talk a little bit about this painting is because Richter really sets out in this work and others like it to explore the effects of post-industrial culture on art. And in a way, his painting of the early 1960s, maybe even into the late 1960s, particularly does that. Now, one of the things that we have to know is that Richter is coming out of East Germany and into the West in the early 1960s, by 1961. He starts to study in Dusseldorf, he works as a photo tech, he's getting exposed to a lot of the mass media imagery that we see referenced here in this painting of an advertisement of a Ferrari from 1964. Two major questions that in his practice he raises in relation to post-industrialism is, what do we paint? What does an artist paint after technology already has done such a great job of reproducing imagery and making pictures? Where does painting go after that? And not only can technology make pictures ad nauseum, either great singular ones or ones in mass quantities, but what happens when technology becomes so integral to the way that we see? What does a painter make of that? Now, it's well known that he wasn't really willing to go the route of abstract expressionism and go into a subjective response. Well, whereas we can just deny the mass aspects of culture and produce marks and paintings that are very autobiographical and subjective. So scholars tell us that one major response is the kind of work that we're looking at here, which he describes as photo paintings. And he made several of these that feature pictures of advertisements focusing on very expensive, luxury, well-made Italian motor cars that were being made in the early 1960s. This particular one, the Ferrari. He also made Fiats and the Alfa Romeo, and so on and so forth. These are paintings that don't try and do away with or deny that photography is here. In fact, they very much do the opposite. They expressly take the kind of photography that he's looking at through advertisement as their subject matter, but they also take some other features of post-industrial culture as their subject matter as well. One is the luxury automobile market. They absolutely signify a kind of transnational consumer or consumption, one that goes, for example, from Italy through Germany and through the rest of Europe. Now, it's not lost in anybody that Italy and Germany had previously been together as colleagues, if you will, in the Second World War, and here's a kind of subtle suggestion that they're going on and circulating goods as well as images, since this is not just a painting of a car, it's a painting of an advertisement of a car, and circulating these kinds of things through a transnational, in other words, moving across borders, consumer network, right? Images, cars, so on and so forth. This is really important because the depiction, if you will, of speed or movement, if that's in fact what we're seeing, suggests a couple of different things. This is more than the blur of modernity. You might think of the early 20th century and, for example, Giacomo Balla was very well known as a futurist artist who wanted to depict the the image of speed. What does speed, such an abstract thing, look like, and how do you depict that? Opposite going on here, he doesn't want to really veer into abstraction. He's not totally losing the consumer good. He's maintaining it while he's presenting speed. Keep in mind that this is speed that's important also in terms of mobility, not just individual mobility about the owner of the car, but social mobility, the person who buys it and how they enter into a cultural status through purchase. Keep in mind the status of the refugee. In a way, Richter is the refugee whose own mobility is still important at this time and having moved from East Germany to the West. So mobility has a significance in that regard too. And the larger layer of nations trying to find ways to interact, again, economically, not through politics, not through war, but in ways that will eventually build a European Union that trades not only through the common euro, but also through people, objects, goods, and information. This certainly references the post-war world of information circulating. After 1945, magazines are really big creators of international or transnational networks so that people living here can see what's going over here and create desire for it. Magazines and the print media are huge drives of creating consumer desire. And as we were talking about with post-industrialism, desire drives economies at this point. It's not just how many cars, it's wanting cars in the first place. Even when we can't afford them, we may want the magazines that bring us the car. So in this case, the magazines are as much a product of and producing desire as are the cars themselves. There's also the layer of commercial photography that gets involved with this. So in some cases, people are starting to make their living because they're great car photographers, or they're great fur coat photographers, or they're great consumer good photographers. There's a sort of cachet and luxury to the photographic image as well. And even though Richter is able to sort of foreground all this and tell us about the car and all these different kinds of layers, he still manages to create a painting that's not a photograph, right? This is a painting that's wholly given over to layers upon layers of photograph, photography, car, place, etc. And still it's not a photograph. And so some scholars suggest he's found a way to salvage a role or a goal for painting, even though that we live in an age of mass reproduction and distribution of photographs. Comments or questions?
I think this painting kind of, it seems very transitional between the two ideas you were talking about, like the production economy and the consumer economy. Like the car is, of course, a product of industrial production, yet it's an advertisement, which is very much sort of a product of consumer culture. And one of the things that I've always found interesting when I was this painting is that there is sort of a clear image of nature that you don't see with most paintings in the modern. There are birch trees and the forest behind it. So in some ways, not completely, I don't know, doesn't seem completely post-industrial, kind of this middle ground.
His erasures of his abstract work? Can you? In what ways?
Well, in most of his abstracts have erasures, have smeared surfaces that go to this speed going across the surface.
The blur is emphasized. Yeah, people have made a lot out of that blur. In this particular case, sometimes people say it's kind of the color of information, or it's a neutral kind of color. It's not shot through with the emotive associations that heightened hues would bring as they're associated with abstract expressionism or its aftermath, particular in the West. That it's a color of reproducibility or no kind of social or personal kind of commitment. It also evokes movement, seeing, a kind of experience of speed, although that's certainly not direct, because we know we're not looking at a car, we're not even looking at a photograph, we're looking at a painting of a reproduction. It may emphasize or remind us that we are still looking at a painting, despite all these references to mass culture and photography.
Well,
Speaking of the background, I mean the kind of imagery that takes shape from the blurred sort of distancing of trees, if that's what they are, also evokes some of his later work that take those shapes, but they're arrived at from his handling of paint in particular ways. And they often refer to digitization and digital culture as opposed to the effects of looking at or recording a photograph. So that's, as a motif, it's interesting to think, and just like you're saying, as a kind of motif, as it carries on through his work.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. At the Rachofsky House? Uh-huh. Yeah. Any other comments or questions? Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem. I was wondering if you think there's more to this sort of blurred aspect in just providing food. You know, one of the things I thought interesting is the irony of this being an advertisement where you want the brand to be very clear to that being completely
I think that's a great observation, right. And I think, you know, one way to think about that is to consider what the brand is. In some cases, you would have enough of a silhouette and a sense of speed to characterize whatever kind of branding characteristics you would have for this particular kind of car. In other cases, you might have made a car so unrecognizable that it wouldn't refer to the Ferrari or the Fiat or the Alfa Romeo and so on and so forth. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to answer that question, I'd want to look at advertisements of this kind of car and what kind of characteristics are being associated with what kind of market. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, I thought we would take a look at the Carl Andre a little bit further in. Are you allowed to put seats on it?
No.
Probably not. There's is there like an occupation limit of?
No, we can.
Oh, do you ever have a problem with like stiletto heels or particular kind of shoes?
Not that I have heard
of. Yeah. All over body touch. Yeah. Well, I think this piece, like you were pointing out with the Gerhard Richter, I see this as a segue piece and transitional in a lot of ways between the industrial and post-industrial. The industrial, so I see it straddling that shift. Andre, of course, uses a lot of materials, particularly his steel, his iron, his metals, that reference an industrial culture. These are dominant normative materials that we associate with modernity, with the industrial age, with the society and culture that begot it. They may refer to that kind of infrastructure of transportation. This is the material that was part of building the railroads. It was also part of the material that not only went laterally or across, but up, right? It was the stuff that was the architectural skeletons for skyscrapers. And that kind of verticality is not only a symbol of the built landscape of modernity, but it's also a symbol of the kind of organization that goes along with modernity in terms of social structure of industry, verticality, vertical organizations of corporations that go from the head guys or managers and incorporate the branding, the advertising, but especially the offices that go out to industry and manufacturing, that kind of vertical orientation of the business world. So these are materials that are key to our economy and well-being. We're used to their presence. They may also allude to Andre's personal work experience. He worked for the railroad, I think for the New Jersey Railroad, for 4 or 5 years. He was a freight brakesman. He was also a conductor. And this kind of reminds me of the sequential moving outwards in a line of sight that were associated with railroad tracks and moving along the land, a kind of progress along the path. They also, in the way that works like these are put together, exhibit very rational organization associated with mechanization, order, balance, symmetry. The structure is apparent, the whole to the part. And yet there's a couple of features that really point to the post-industrial. And the most important of that is their invitation to direct use. Their invitation to look at sculpture as something that happens in our space and uses our bodies, that can change our perception of our space in relation to ourselves as we're using it. That aspect of direct use of people from everyday life, not just the people, somebody who owns it, but everybody who walks by, and their ability to participate in an ad hoc, temporal way that can't necessarily be scheduled or regimented, speaks to the aspect of randomness, direct use, and integration. And that kind of interest of use, reception, perception is all erring on or falling on the post-industrial, being about the consumer, the audience, the user, etc., as opposed to the maker, particularly in regard to the way that it highlights our own sense of who we are and where we are, touching, feeling, rethinking space in regard to his reorientation of sculpture from the vertical to the horizontal. I also see this allegorically, and I think this is quite a stretch, but so much of the way that post-industrial culture is written about takes its cue from horizontality, from getting away from or doing away with certain kinds of hierarchies that are vertical and moving towards a landscape that is horizontal and flat, where people make choices across a range of equally okay, no better, no worse possibilities. And so I see this move towards flatness and horizontality as a kind of allegory for a lot of the culture of the post-industrial age. What do you all think? The what? Well, I think this is a piece from 81, but I'm thinking of it in relation to the work he was doing in the 60s when he started to do work. I mean, it also, something else we could talk about is the emphasis on domestication, taking something that belongs to the upright, the orientation of the figure moving and walking through space, and instead rendering sculpture as something belongs, something that is localized and becomes part of our place. Lots of feminist scholars have associated this work with quilts, with carpeting, with patterning, with floor covers, in that sense of domestication, taking it out of a public, anonymous place and bringing it into more intimate kinds of interactions with the space that is lived in by the body, by the self. By a real self, a material person in space, as opposed to a civic ideal where you might see a sculpture that refers to a figure or a person and so on. Well, I think the installation asks you to do that. It's a very different orientation that retains the verticality of traditional sculpture. It also reminds us of traditions of sculpture that are vertical and that belong to relief. Things that are part of walls that might be carved, that come out, but ultimately remain part of a building or an institution, a space, so on. So there's a sense of removal in all the ways that you're talking about.
Thank you very much for your saying about the frame of the transportation.
projects of modern art is to sort of just publicize this viewing experience that Sylvain does, that this does here, and it kind of, and I still have a hard time even bringing myself to step on it, because it sort of, it troubles that idea of the reverence for art, sort of something to be roped off and not touched. And that is one of the things that Andre is doing here.
I agree. I think it's really difficult to walk on his work because of all the ways that we've been taught not to touch or get close to. And, you know, you can get close to these things and you're still sort of looking around for a guard to come up and say, don't step on that. So a kind of tactile body connection with things is really questionable in just the ways that you're talking about. Yeah, absolutely.
It's certainly taking art off of the pedestal.
Yes, and when you move it off the pedestal, again, that vertical kind of orientation, he's really spreading it around and moving it to a place. And, you know, think of the floor. This is basic fundamental structure. It's also not the place we usually orient our attention in a museum. We're looking at things that are eye level or that are, like you said, they're upheld. Those pedestals are signifiers for importance. And here we've got to look down and sort of worry about whether it's okay to keep going. It's in our space. Can we recognize that and keep moving? Yeah. Okay.
One thing I was thinking about is, for me, it kind of evokes kind of a grappling honesty I have to do in regards to valuing process and kind of age we're in. Whereas I look at this art and I'm thinking, well, you don't step on it because you want to preserve it. And you're like, well, is that what it's really intended? You know, like what we're talking about with this particular communication. So at the same time, if its objective is to talk about that kind of experiential perception, then I'm really not preserving really much of what its intent is by not walking on it. And so in a way, it's kind of like, well, how honest am I with myself in regards to, I guess, being a person of this age, age of information or something like that?
Well, you know, we get all kinds of contradictory signals about the user-friendliness of works of art. This is one that is intended, and many of his pieces on the floor are supposed to be walked on. They are for use. Again, that post-industrial emphasis on meaning develops in use, by users and reception, you know, by markets and consumers and everything. But at the same time, there are real concerns because many of his pieces are owned by cultural institutions that want to maintain his works for everybody's use in perpetuity. And so there are real world concerns about conserving things. I mean, like you were saying, you can't actually really have 100 people on this at one time. And there are also limits about interacting anyway, like you were saying with the third graders. It's not okay to pick it up and move it and take it out of its placement. And so there is that kind of conflictedness that goes on with the presentation of pieces despite what they were intended to do. There's a reality of where they live today and what the concerns of where they live are. Yes?
The Industrial Revolution and skyscrapers and reinforced steel and all that.
Right. The air column over this piece is important to the artist. Well, yeah, but I would also take that to mean the totality of the environment in which the piece is, so that I understand that comment to say, listen, don't just look at this thing as a thing. Look at it relationally in regard to the air over it, in regard to its surroundings. So not simply the verticality, but the environment, the locality of it, I think is really key. Like the candy piles that you would take a piece of?
One of the things I think about, somewhat contradictory, is the material he uses.
because you don't think of steel as being the most welcoming thing for
Well, again, there's that conflicted kind of thing. It's often the case that metals are very responsive to human touch. There's reasons why you can't go around and touch metal things in museums because, you know, the grease, the oil, the fingerprint, they'll indelibly mark. Look at statues' noses where people have touched and rubbed and things. So there is that potential, but in a cultural way, you know, metal signifies the kinds of things that you're talking about just as well. Impersonality, the coldness, it's used for structural kinds of things. It's not considered a kind of intimate material, and yet that touch has the potential, and he's asking us in a way to bring that touch to the work. Yeah. So I wanted to wrap up with a look at two pieces in the Eric Parker installation. I wanted to wrap up by looking at two paintings in the Eric Parker installation. The one bona fide from 2008, and I can't remember what the title of this piece is. The New Freedom from 2008 also. I think they do similar but also slightly different things. This one in regard to bringing forth some of the complexities and contradictions of realities in a post-industrial world. What does bona fide mean? If you say something is bona fide, maybe you don't go around saying things are bona fide. Okay, well, I looked it up, you know, because what do I know? I just teach. And bona fide means in good faith, right? Without deceit, without fraud. It can refer to your credentials, your bona fide, some people refer to, what proves who you are or what you are. And this kind of refers to a world of truth versus lies or real versus fake, clear-cut distinction. Now, there's a lot about what's going on, however, in bona fide that's not very bona fide or that puts that into question. One of the things that struck me about this piece was its aspect of portraying a stage or some kind of presentation structure. I'm looking at these kinds of things as little lights and some kind of statement here, as if there's the visual architecture of display. It even reminded me of some of Degas' paintings and pastels, where he has the orchestra down below and the stage and the ballerinas are lit up and stuff. And so I'm looking at this as some kind of television screen or screen, but also a stage for presentation, evoking presentation or display, which would conflate us with assumed viewers of this thing as some kind of audience maybe once removed watching this presentation. And the problem is, of course, that the stage or the theater or the screen is artifice. It's not bona fide. It raises all sorts of questions about what's real or not real. And so the branded kind of statement seems to be undercut a bit or contrasted by some of the cultural references that we see about presentation and display. Something else that might call into question the bona fide is the sense that we have a lot of stuff here. I'm not sure what we're seeing as creatures that morph into one another or many kinds of something. The symbols evoke, you know, imagery from Picasso to Ernst to Mayan hieroglyphs. We see them neatly organized in registers, almost like hieroglyphic kinds of writing. This might even evoke film strips. Some of it might look like anime. There's a kind of truth or organization to keep everything in a register and nice and neat, but there's no clear sense of focus. Nothing stands out as the ultimate central image of this. There isn't a key knowledge or truth that we're being presented with. We almost get too much of something without end. It could keep on going on forever and ever. So these are some of the ways that I'm seeing a kind of conflictedness between the title and what it means and the presentation of what we're seeing. The imagery itself, critics have talked about in the ways that I've had, that this is an artist who makes many different kinds of cultural references, who presents them in ways that don't privilege one over another, who brings to mind a cultural memory even, or an archiving of difference, so that it's the archive overall, the collection of the thing that ends up mattering more than whether any single entity is more truthful or a better example of the theme of the archive than any other kind of example. In relation to that, the piece back here I see as a great piece to end this discussion because I see it as an example of what scholars talk about as the post-human. And post-humanism or the post-human may be a sort of morphing of humanity that happens in the post-industrial age. Now, one of the things that this creature seems to be doing is emphasizing mouth here and eyes that seem to be staring or looking in a particular kind of direction, reminding me of looking as the gaze, the world of the spectacle, always being connected by a desire through sight and vision, and the mouth through a world of consumption, taking in, always being fluidly in and out through some kind of orifice. The post-human refers to an idea of the human being who is not cut off from the environment, but who is made up of the environment as much as the environment is made up of the human being. It's a human creature who always consists of or is constructed of the world around him or her. This is a creature who seems to be built on the stuff outside of the world, particularly references to spectacles of light or entertainment or toys or even organic kinds of morphing, whereas parts of the inner anatomy and self change or are fluidly in process to another shape. There's a spectacular animated entertainment quality about this kind of self, whereas we are of our environment and world as much as it shapes as we shape it. What do you think? Well, the post-human really comes out of discussions about technology that want to explain to people it's not that we're human and over here are machines and technology. It's that we are already always cyborgs. We're already something else besides a body. An example of this is we take vitamins. They are chemical constructions that enhance things in our body. And so there's something from outside that has reshaped, reconfigured, extended, expanded, intensified, bettered, improved who we are. It's pharmacology, right? That's an example of being a cyborg, a post-human, somebody who consists of stuff that's already out there. You can think more drastically of like Arnold Schwarzenegger films where he's got bionic kinds of limbs or has machine parts or any kind of science fiction where the human has been married to a machine component. That's also post-human. A combination of what seems organic and inorganic has been combined to create an entity. And that's what I'm talking about here. A creature who seems to have that kind of combination of the organic or inorganic. It's also, this is part of a long tradition of using a not particular face and bust up to about here on the human body, not so much as an individual portrait, but as a portrait of a civilization, a portrait of a culture that reflects the condition of human being back to us in any kind of particular age. And often, there it's allegory with a message, like, you know, we shouldn't be this kind of person, or look at what we're turning into. Look at the kinds of things that we're made of. Is this good or bad? Some of examples in this kind of tradition can inherently pose ethical questions about whether we like what we see, or is this a true portrayal, or how much does it actually fit with the human condition at this point. We can also even talk about the style of the painting as kind of incorporating the environment into the cell. Again, referring to anime, cartooning, certain kinds of school of imagery, like in Chicago in the 60s and 70s, incorporated into a portrait of this particular creature. Not clearly man or woman, androgynous perhaps, a little bit of Dr. Seuss thrown in there. Yeah, immediate access. No kind of clothing to contain or keep apart or keep autonomous or distinct. I don't know. Possibly. I think there's probably ways to talk in a narrative sense, or talk, you know, make up a story about in what ways the words relate to images. But on the other hand, they're as loaded as cultural signifiers as any other imagery that he seems to use as well. I mean, they, in that sense, they're on equal footing with some of his imagery. But the kind of connection that you're talking about between the figure and his environment here suggests, I understand what you're saying about less freedom and more, it's a foregone conclusion, you are the stuff of the world. I mean, this the world has made you. It's pretty unidirectional in terms of determination from society and culture to the individual kind of thing. As opposed to having agency, which is kind of what you're asking. Where is human agency and the ability to think, have a will, and act? Any other thoughts, comments? Well, thank you very much for all your comments.